period collected and saved the pubic hair of their lovers as a souvenir. And I guess there must be a more disgusting souvenir you could have of someone you love. But I honestly can't think of one. I guess if you saved their urine.
Urine in a jar. Anything in a jar, really. There's always a bad vibe.
Not even good, really, if it's just fingernails.
Or a breath in a jar somehow is still haunting. Oh, that, you know what I mean?
Well, that is haunting and disgusting.
Maybe I just don't like jars.
Oh, also, just a comment. I would like to have it be noted, because I lived during the period where they kept talking about bra burning, and there really wasn't, in my experience, any bra burning. There was a PR stunt once by some group of women who burned bras, and it was on TV. And from that point on, it was one of those stupid things that journalists all got their teeth around. You know, like everybody kept mentioning bra burning, but I don't think anybody, maybe one other group of sorority girls once got drunk and burned bras, but nobody else was really burning bras. Not wearing bras, yes, but burning them, too, no, nobody was doing that. It's just stupid and expensive.
Well, just surely from a financial standpoint, yeah, it wouldn't make any sense. If you're already earning, you know, 60-something cents to a man's dollar, and bras are at least five at that time, $5. I mean, my bras still are $5. I buy them used. We'll talk about this after the recording. But you're just, it's like setting fire to a $5 bill.
Used bras? Ew. You might as well save pubic hair if you're going to buy used bras.
I wash them first. All right. I'm not a monster. I made a note. I think this is our first chapter without marital rape in it.
Oh.
I don't know how we did that.
Oh, that's sad.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
I kind of feel a little tinge of loss, to be completely honest.
Oh. Well, I'm going to make sure there's marital rape in the next chapter. No matter what the chapter is.
Yeah, I'm going to double down.
All
yeah.
Right.
It's going to be all marital rape.
Yeah.
Because we have that quota, you know?
I think that the title of the next chapter is marital rape, so we should mention it at least once.
Yes.
All right. Chapter 10, Medicine.
Woe be to Queen Nefertiti, captured and sold as a slave. Shanghaied by Caesar to Rome, where he needs her to put all his
okay, so this chapter is all about the adventures of women in medicine, and I'm glad we did this chapter because I'm pretty sure there are no indignities for women anywhere in this field.
Right, right, right. Sure, sure, sure. But can you put a pin in that for a second? I need to ask you a question. Does this look infected to you?
I'm pretty sure my opinion doesn't matter at all, although I am, I think, permitted to give you a lobotomy as a writer if I know I can sell a piece to The New Yorker about it.
Mm. Well, I'm pretty sure my doctor's opinion doesn't matter either. Have I told you about the time that he sighed into my vagina?
No, and I'm going to encourage you never to tell me that story if it's not too late.
I'm afraid it's too late. I mean, he was saying what we're all thinking, of course, but still, pretty unprofessional.
I've had only women doctors for the last 15 years, except for one male surgeon that I had who, the night before I went into surgery, actually said to me, well, the boys and I have been up all night partying, so we're ready to go, which made me laugh really hard because I like to pretend that he was kidding.
There's nothing like sharing a laugh with your oppressor, am I right?
It's all right, especially when you know you're going to be out cold in 30 seconds. When I was a kid, doctor was one of those jobs I expected to find filled by a slightly intimidating older white man, just like I did game show host, high school principal, or garbage collector. Because that's how it was when America was great again that first time. No women ever had this job. And I never asked why, since I knew the answer was because. Though, as it turns out, it didn't start out that way. There were female doctors as far back as 2700 BC in ancient Egypt, and on and off all through history. But to find out how Western medicine ended up being dominated completely by men until very recently, we have to make another unpleasant trip back to the Middle Ages when, from the 5th to the 13th centuries, the church didn't approve of medicine as a profession. The only kind of healing they sanctioned was prayer, unless you were aristocracy, in which case court-appointed physicians for kings were fine. Back then, there was no standardized medical practice. The only healing services available for poor peasants and working people came via folk medicine practitioners, usually in the form of a village wise woman, later labeled a witch. It was she who offered herbal remedies collected over the years, painkillers, digestive aids, anti-inflammatory agents, like ergot, which was a mold that grew on grains and was used to reduce the pain of labor, something the church was so firmly against that in 1591, a woman named Euphane McLean was burned at the stake for taking a pain-relieving herb while giving birth to twins, because the Book of Genesis clearly stated that God wanted women to suffer during childbirth. It's right there, plain as day, under his eye. In the 1200s, European medicine was just establishing itself as a profession requiring university training, and universities didn't allow women. So this meant only men could be doctors. By the way, as a sample of their fine work, the official physician to King Edward II, who had a doctorate in medicine from Oxford, treated a toothache by writing on the jaws of his patient, "In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, Amen." So the male medical establishment decided to increase their influence by entering into a collaboration with the all-powerful church, agreeing to accept certain church-imposed controls, like always having an advising priest on board. This consolidation of power reached its high point during the witch trials, where doctors were asked to make final judgments about which women were actually witches. In the definitive book on witchcraft and law, Malleus Maleficarum, it actually says, quote, "If it's asked how it's possible to distinguish whether an illness is caused by witchcraft or some natural physical defect, we answer that the first way is by means of the judgment of doctors." And thus, by the 1300s, male doctors succeeded in developing a monopoly over the practice of medicine. And since everything is never enough for the wealthy and powerful, during the Renaissance, the male doctors decided to also grab control of childbirth. Sure, midwives who had been doing the job for all the centuries prior were far more experienced, but through persistence, by the 17th and 18th centuries, the growing male medical establishment managed to effectively discredit the very idea of female practitioners. But wait, backing up for just a second. First, it was non-professional male practitioners who grabbed childbirth from the midwives. Barber surgeons, as they were called in England, who gained power over the field of obstetrics by claiming technical superiority because they used forceps. And forceps were legally classified as a surgical instrument, which meant women couldn't even own them. Yes, pregnant women were now forced to spread their legs and trust the birth of their baby to a barber. But to be fair, it's hard to give a man a haircut. They're so picky. Leave it long on the top, take a little off the sides. You know the men's, it's always something. Anyway, the midwives protested, charging the barbers with commercialism, but popular opinion had turned against female practitioners. Oh, and infant mortality went up. So it became accepted that this new class of professionally trained and more expensive regular doctors, as they were now called, would be exclusively middle-class men. Even though their formal training, which sometimes only took a few months, didn't involve any body of medical science. Instead, they were taught to treat most illnesses with what were known as heroic measures, like massive bleeding or huge doses of laxatives. In many cases, the cures were worse than the sickness. Sir Oliver Wendell Holmes, Sr., famed physician and poet, said that if all the medicines used by the regular doctors in the U.S. were thrown into the ocean, it would be better for mankind and worse for the fish. Nevertheless, by 1800, the male doctors, with their ties to the upper classes and business, successfully took over obstetrics from the midwives. By 1830, 13 states passed medical licensing laws outlawing what was now being called irregular practice. In the 1830s and 40s, there was a big pushback from a new female-driven group called the Popular Health Movement, who proposed controversial treatments like whole grain cereal, temperance, birth control, and loose-fitting female clothing. Also, frequent bathing, which was still regarded as a vice by many of the regular doctors. This coincided with the creation of the new Ladies' Physiological Societies, a women's club that sponsored sold-out lectures about many taboo subjects like female anatomy and preventative health care. Specifically by women, for women. This attempt to reclaim some power had the male regular doctors running scared for a while. So in 1848, when they formed the American Medical Association, they launched a full-out coordinated attack on women practitioners, asking questions like, well, how can a respectable woman travel at night to a medical emergency? And if a woman did manage to get accepted into a medical school, her professors would refuse to discuss anatomy as long as a lady was present. In 1847, Harriet Hunt was almost the first woman to attend Harvard Medical School. Dr. Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., then the dean of school, initially accepted her application. But the all-male student body threatened to riot if she attended, followed by an editorial in the New York Times chiding her for being one of the dozen women in the United States who pined because nature did not make them men. But too bad. By 1849, Elizabeth Blackwell succeeded in becoming America's first woman regular doctor, even though her alma mater, a small school in upstate New York, quickly passed a resolution afterwards barring any further female enrollment. Also filed under the topic of unexpected consequences, Elizabeth Blackwell eventually admitted that her commitment to a medical career had risen out of a desire to fight the misdeeds of male doctors. Meanwhile, in a related story, the hospitals during this period were apparently just warehouses for the dying poor, and hospital nurses were known for their drunkenness, thievery, and prostitution, which I guess at least made being a patient a little more interesting. Enter Dorothea Dix and Florence Nightingale, the women who reinvented nursing as an occupation for classier dames. Both women were a product of upper-class Victorian upbringing, now in their 30s, and facing the boredom of spinsterhood. They managed to sell the idea of the Nightingale nurse to the irascible male medical establishment by presenting her as a completely obedient helpmate who could set the doctors free from the tedium of bedside caretaking. The Nightingale nurse would be the embodiment of femininity as defined by Victorian society, second only to motherhood, because, quote, woman is an instinctive nurse, but not an instinctive doctor. When they've tried to be men, they've succeeded only in being third-rate men. In other words, nursing was feminine, they said, doctoring masculine, even though most nursing work at the time was mainly poorly paid housework. Also, the new Nightingale nurse was schooled in a bunch of upper-class affectations like tea pouring, art appreciation, makeup use, and wearing girdles, which I bet was especially great if you were hospitalized during an art gallery opening. And with that, nursing schools were the new destination of choice for working girls not eager to work in a factory. And having at last found a place to work inside the health system, a lot of women gave up any further thought of applying to medical school. Remember, this was the Victorian period, when a woman's role was supposed to be homemaking, period. At the time, the budding American women's movement was mainly focused on getting women the vote. And once they succeeded with that, they forgot about their agenda about opening up other professions to women, allowing a new idea to catch on. Why forsake motherhood for the petty pursuits of males? Instead, how about thinking of domestic life as an exciting vocation all its own? We'll call it the field of domestic science. See, a woman can have it all. She can be a nurse, a teacher, a counselor, a million great things, all by staying home. Okay, and getting no pay, but see, everything's perfect after all. Except for another unexpected consequence. An ever-increasing number of Victorian-era women having what were called nervous breakdowns. A condition characterized by depression, fatigue, weakness, migraines, plus despair, hopelessness, a sense of uselessness, the inability to take pleasure in any aspect of life. All the symptoms we now associate with the 2016 election. Since everything was perfect, why did so many Victorian women seem to be going crazy? Well, it might have had something to do with the fact that during the 1800s, the entirely male field of physicians and the new field of male psychiatrists used a list of warning signs for a mentally ill female that included, if you can believe it, reading, writing, and getting an education, along with any other activities that might contribute to an outside identity. I know this sounds satirical, but it's true. According to the ever-growing completely male psychiatric establishment, the large number of women feeling too weak to get out of bed in the morning had nothing at all to do with the social mandate that if a woman didn't focus all her attention on homemaking, she could be committed to an insane asylum by her father or husband without any recourse to appeal. A woman who exhibited too much defiance or emotional discontent with her lot in life was diagnosed with hysteria and put on bed rest, seclusion, and bland food, and forbidden participation in any challenging mental activities. There was so much of this so-called female madness going around that in 1840, famous English physician Thomas Laycock, known for his classification of mental illnesses, describes hysteria as a woman's natural state. A brief history of hysteria. The word itself originates from the ancient Greek word for uterus and was used to cover a variety of symptoms, including anxiety, shortness of breath, insomnia, irritability, nervousness, and also, for good measure, sexually forward behavior. It was first identified between the 5th and 3rd centuries BC by Greek physician Hippocrates, who was also the proud inventor of the term. To his credit, he took a big step forward in the field of gender-based mental health by declaring that mental illness was not caused by supernatural forces. Then he took an equally big step backwards by deciding that all female behavior considered problematic was caused by the uterus becoming toxic if a woman had an inadequate sex life. This theory started out as a treatise by Plato about how the gods created desire for sexual intercourse by giving the male penis and the female uterus a will of their own. Plato portrayed the penis and the uterus as animated creatures capable of a degree of self-rule, something he obviously extrapolated by watching his own out-of-control organ. Don't forget, this group of so-called Greek experts on everything saw women as inferior versions of men, physically identical, except that they had an internal penis. So it just made sense that the uterus, or internal penis, was also capable of behaving like a wild animal, as the penis does. This begat the idea of the wandering uterus, an internal organ off on a devil-may-care road trip throughout a woman's body, producing anxiety, tremors, insanity, convulsions, and paralysis wherever it spent the night, but turning especially cantankerous when deprived of its childbearing function. Then it had no way to expel the buildup of its female semen except to produce toxic fumes. The standard cure was scent therapy, in which good smells were placed under a woman's vagina and bad odors at her nose, forcing that surly uterus back to its original spot. Oddly enough, Plato had no parallel theories about any dangerous toxic symptoms being produced by the headstrong penis. No, thank God, the penis was totally fine. No problems there at all. Anyway, this wandering uterus theory, developed before anyone had ever dissected a female body and had an actual look at a uterus, was pretty much the central plank of women's medical care. For example, let's say the uterus packed a light lunch and spent the day wandering to a spot under the diaphragm. Well, then the woman would become speechless, experience suffocation, grind her teeth, and, when called, not respond. Which, oh boy, sounds a lot like me. Anyway, 50 years after Plato's death, when a female corpse was finally dissected, Team Wandering Uterus presumably went, whoops, my bad, when they noticed ligaments and tissue anchoring the uterus into an unmovable place. Which is not to imply that doctors now finally understood what was going on in the female body. Nope, not at all. By the 2nd century, legendary Roman physician Galen had simply shifted his focus back to the negative effects caused by the buildup of female semen, the result of women not having enough intercourse. And this theory about unreleased lady sperm continued for centuries. Ah, but better times lay ahead. By the time the splendors of the Middle Ages rolled around, 1,000 years later, physicians no longer connected hysteria to the uterus. Now the truth was clear. Hysteria was caused by the devil. And the cure was an exorcism and, of course, being burned alive. Which brings us neatly back to the Victorian era in the 1800s. Society had come too far to fall for that crazy devil stuff now, so Victorian male doctors returned to the time-honored theory of the toxic, fume-spewing uterus. In fact, there was such a revival by psychiatrists, psychologists, and anti-feminists of the idea that female reproductive organs cause mental illness that in the last quarter of the 19th century, most women carried a bottle of smelling salts in their handbag as a remedy. Then, whenever they felt too much emotion, which they feared might cause them to swoon, a word that they used to mean partial or total collapse of consciousness, well, the pungent odor of the smelling salts would cause the uterus to settle down and allow the women to return to their senses. Of course, for some gynecologists, the best cure for uterus-based craziness was simply to remove a woman's reproductive organs. including the clitoris. Blessed be the fruit. But the most commonly prescribed treatment remained finding a husband, and all that that entails. Such a great idea because, as everyone knows, all traces of female craziness end the minute a marriage begins. Victorian psychiatric wisdom claimed that male dominance was therapeutic. So true, it actually doesn't even matter which domineering male you're talking about. Therefore, husbands and fathers were asked to help protect the evolutionary process by agreeing to hospitalize any female family members who behaved in a manner contrary to nature, by which they meant taking care of the house and being a mother. A woman seeking pleasure via, say, protected sex, masturbation, lesbianism, etc., was allowing herself to be masculinized and actually causing her reproductive system to deregulate and overheat, leading to madness and death. What nature wanted for women was to stick to indoor activities and to avoid all outdoor activities like sports and, well, anything requiring intellectual passion because it would be physically dangerous for the fragile female brain. Of course, the doctors and scientists who subscribed to this ideology also believed that the desire of a woman to vote, study, work at a job, or do other masculine things was pushing society down a slippery slope and into a world of degenerate, sexless individuals bent on turning the human race into an ant colony. Naturally, there was fancy research to back this up. In 1879, in a celebrated study based on 400 dissected human brains by James Crichton Browne, collaborator of Charles Darwin, it was revealed that men's brains, on average, weighed a bit more than women's, which to him meant that women had fewer powers of intellect and reason. Infuriated feminists argued that the emotional reactions being observed in women were actually the result of trying to live inside the unfair expectations of a repressive society. But obviously, these were arguments produced by underweight little brains full of toxic fumes. Meanwhile, all this wrongful hospitalizing of women for attitude problems also begat another unexpected consequence: a rash of female-authored exposés full of terrifying anecdotes about the treatment of women inside asylums. Treatments included bloodletting, blistering, dousing patients in either boiling or ice-cold water to shock them, and using physical restraints such as straitjackets. After Elizabeth Packard, who was confined to an institution by her husband, won her freedom, she wrote a best-selling exposé advocating asylum reform and women's rights. Called the Packard Laws, the new reforms increased the number of people involved in the commitment process. In 1887, a young reporter named Elizabeth Cochran, who wrote under the byline Nellie Bly, had herself committed to an asylum so she could write a piece for the New York World called 10 Days in a Madhouse. Here's a tiny piece of it. "From the moment I entered the insane ward on the island, I made no attempt to keep up my assumed role of insanity. I talked and acted just as I do in ordinary life. Yet, strange to say, the more sanely I talked and acted, the crazier I was thought to be." Which, by the way, also sounds a lot like receiving network notes on a sitcom. Nellie Bly goes on to tell the stories of women she met inside. For example, one woman spoke only French. The French woman, unable to talk to her doctors, began crying in fear of never getting out. So the attendants choked her. After Bly's editor got Bly released and the piece was published, it caused such an outrage that the asylum also had no choice but to implement some reforms. Oh, and remember Harriet Hunt, rejected from Harvard Medical School? Well, she went on to practice medicine for 25 years. In 1860, when she finally retired, there was a party for three generations of her patients. Addressing the group, she had the following words for the women present. "I've been so happy in my work, every moment occupied," she said. "How I long to whisper in the ear of every listless woman, do something if you would be happy." From the 1890s on, as more and more doctors began to encounter competent female colleagues who proved themselves to be excellent practitioners, they had to face up to the evidence that the female brain was not quite as feeble as everyone thought. There was apparently no clear evidence that women could not undertake men's occupations. Who knew? Though I'm pretty sure they all would have been diagnosed with hysteria and committed once they learned that in 2017, the number of women enrolled in U.S. medical schools actually exceeded the number of men.
So So in the 5th to 13th centuries, when the church basically outlawed medicine unless you're rich, did they expect people to just pray the pain away? That sounds about as effective as praying the gay away.
Well, you know, God was pretty clear in the Garden of Eden that the women were just supposed to be in pain and would be punished for the rest of their lives. As far as I know, a couple thousand years before that, they had poppies and were making opium in the Middle Eastern countries. So I don't know if that made it to Europe, but if it did, my guess is that the women could scream in pain and then the men would just get a glass of whiskey and a crack pipe.
Oh, no. Women had to wait until the 1800s to be prescribed opium for female troubles. In fact, they ended up outnumbering males 3-1 in the late 19th and early 20th century as opium addicts.
Really?
Sweet relief. Yeah. By relief, I mean, you know, debilitating addiction.
I am so relieved that it's not just for men anymore.
Yay. So, during the time of the witch trials, how would a doctor determine whether or not a woman was a witch? Like, throw her in an enormous bedpan and see if she floated, or...?
They were taking her physical appearance into account. Apparently, they would examine her. They would strip her and examine her, and they would look for things like witch's marks, devil's marks, something called suck spots. Were hickeys even a thing when you were a teenager?
I think hickeys are perennially a teen thing, though maybe now, maybe the teens give it to each other on their assholes. The teens love eating ass these days. I read about it in Teen Vogue.
Well, what is the deal on hickeys anyway? Was that part of the curriculum in eighth grade? I've never had anybody offer to give me a hickey since eighth grade.
Well, I mean, I went to a public school, so yeah, it is.
Ah.
Ataraxia means peace of mind, and that, even more than money, is what most of us want to find. Today, medical science recognizes that some folks aren't helped by relaxing exercises. Doctors are now prescribing an ataraxic medicine. It makes those who fear they're about to quit feel like they're ready to begin, bidding their darkened spirits goodbye for the calming peace of a cloudless sky.
Before I became employed in the growth industry that is writing about women's victimhood, I participated in medical studies for money. While I couldn't help but notice that the overwhelming majority of my fellow lab rats were male, I didn't know this was by design. It turns out hack comedians are right. Men and women are different, albeit on a biological level. Yet women have been excluded from medical research for centuries, even though the treatments that arise from such research affect the sexes differently. Men, specifically white ones, were assumed to be the norm by which all others were compared, an assumption that, according to the Institute of Medicine, led women to be viewed as deviant or problematic, even in studying diseases that affect both sexes. Hell, even female animals have historically been excluded from studies. But you know how moody lady apes can get when it's their time of the month, am I right, fellas? Lack of representation in clinical trials means women get the short end of the stick when it comes to medication. A 2012 study published in the American Journal of Clinical Dermatology found that women are almost twice as likely as men to experience adverse drug reactions. Now, I'm no doctor. I'm no scientist either, since I grew up in an era in which girls were taught that the word stem meant the stalk of a pretty little flower and nothing else. Nevertheless, it seems to me like the primary way to prevent women from having adverse drug reactions would be to include them in the research process. But hey, again, I'm no expert. I'm a woman, after all. The only thing I have encyclopedic knowledge of is self-loathing. For decades, the justification used for excluding females from clinical studies was a misguided attempt to protect them. And by them, I mean the babies they might, at some indeterminate point in the future, carry in their uteruses. A series of policies designed to protect human research subjects arose after World War II that, while not explicitly barring women of childbearing age from participating in studies, lumped pregnant women into the category of vulnerable populations. This made researchers reticent to involve any woman who was or could become pregnant in drug-related research. While excluding women was the norm, it wasn't official policy. That is, until 1977, when the Food and Drug Administration issued the guideline General Considerations for the Clinical Evaluation of Drugs, which essentially banned women of childbearing potential from participating in Phase 1 clinical trials. Which is how things remained until 1993, when the FDA finally lifted their 1977 restrictions and the National Institutes of Health Revitalization Act, which mandated the inclusion of women and minorities in NIH-sponsored clinical trials, was passed. Though I should note that not all clinical trials are sponsored by the NIH. In fact, the number of NIH-funded trials decreased by 24% between 2006 and 2014, and the number of drug industry-sponsored trials increased by over 40%. As of 2015, for-profit ventures run 6 times more trials than academic ones. Big Pharma isn't just my rap name. It's big business, ladies and gentlemen. In 1998, the FDA published the delightfully redundant Investigational New Drug Applications and New Drug Applications, which allowed the agency the right to refuse to file any new drug application that didn't analyze safety and efficacy data by sex. But just because it allows the agency to do so doesn't necessarily mean it has to. Many studies are still conducted almost exclusively on men. And I will now tell you about one that, devoid of hyperbole, made my jaw drop when I first read about it. I'd like to say nothing surprises me anymore at this point, but when I read this, I had to lay down with a wet rag on my head. So ladies, and the 10 to 15 gentlemen listening, thanks fellas, you're true allies, may I present to you the saga of flibanserin. Sold under the brand name Addy, flibanserin is, as of 2018, the only FDA medication approved for the treatment of female libido disorders. In case you're wondering how many meds the FDA have approved to treat male sexual disorders, the answer is 26. Adding insult to injury, their pills work. By the way, if they work too well, over 4 hours well, call a doctor. Flibanserin, however, has an effectiveness rate of between 8 and 13%. Oh, and it costs $800 a month. Oh, and combining it with alcohol could actually result in a fatally low drop in blood pressure. When the FDA asked the manufacturer of flibanserin to investigate the drug's interaction with alcohol, they put together a study involving only 25 subjects, 23 of which were men. The trial was 92% male for a drug marked exclusively to women that could, you know, literally fucking kill them if they, say, drank a few glasses of wine while they happened to be taking it. Why, you may ask, was it approved by the FDA? Because of a splashy PR campaign designed to guilt them for not approving other, vastly more effective, female libido medications, of course. The manufacturer of flibanserin, which was rejected twice by the FDA before its approval, spent shitloads on creating their own advocacy group and obtaining letters of support for the pill from institutions like the National Organization of Women, American Sexual Health Association, and the Association of Reproductive Health Professionals, as well as several easily lobbyable members of Congress. Sprout Pharmaceuticals' Even the Score campaign pushed the idea that, were they to not approve the drug, the FDA would be supporting gender inequality. Despite the fact that Dr. Adrian Few Berman, the director of Georgetown University's Farmed Out Project, told an FDA advisory committee, quote, "To approve this drug will set the worst kind of precedent, that companies that spend enough money can force the FDA to approve useless or dangerous drugs," the committee voted 18-6 to do exactly that. Don't you just love capitalism? After all, it's the reason why this uplifting passage from Marilyn French's book From Eve to Dawn, A History of Women in the World exists. Corporations obsessed with profit are indifferent to human well-being, and third world governments have few controls over them. Pharmaceutical companies dump birth control pills on unsuspecting populations, often with the support of U.S. aid programs. They charge many times more than they do in industrialized countries for such products. Companies exhort mothers to use powdered milk, although in countries with unsafe water, it produces milk that makes babies sick or kills them, end quote. Using birth control as a form of population control is nothing new. In fact, it's part of America's rich, vile history. During the Progressive Era, which ran from 1890 to 1920, we were the first country to undertake compulsory sterilization programs for the purposes of eugenics. We were so good at practicing eugenics, as a matter of fact, the Nazis were actually inspired by our work. Proponents of eugenics believed that, via selective breeding, the genetic quality of society could be maintained, with Anglo-Saxons naturally being the highest quality of all. They opposed immigration and interracial marriage and supported the sterilization of the poor, disabled, and mentally ill. They were fucking morons, but their ideas were very popular. The American eugenics movement was widely accepted in the academic community. By 1928, there were almost 400 university courses dedicated to it, and eugenics research received mucho dinero from venerable organizations like the Carnegie Institution and Rockefeller Foundation. Even our old pal John Kellogg threw his flake into the ring, partially funding the Race Betterment Foundation in Battle Creek, Michigan. In 1907, Indiana became the first state to enact sterilization legislation. Washington and California followed suit in 1909. 32 states eventually had eugenic plans on the books, a horrifying trend that was kicked off by a 1927 Supreme Court ruling. The case, Buck v. Bell, ruled that a Virginia state statute which permitted compulsory sterilization at a home for the intellectually disabled was not unconstitutional. In his ruling, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. wrote, "It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. The principle that sustains compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes. In the wake of Buck v. Bell, over 62,000 people in the United States, most of them women, were sterilized. Eugenicists considered women to be more accountable than men when it came to the reproduction of undesirables, since they were the ones who actually gave birth. For this reason, women were the primary targets of sterilization. Because one of the fundamental tenets of eugenics was a belief in class status as a designation of fitness, upper and middle class women were encouraged to breed in order to better the race. This often resulted in them having the opposite problem of their poor counterparts, in that they were denied sterilization and birth control. Well, pretty much every reasonable person can now agree eugenics is fucked and a gross violation of human rights. Those who disagree, by the way, can get fucked. Buck v. Bell was never overturned, and the Virginian sterilization law that started it all wasn't repealed until 1974. The involuntary sterilization of African American and Native American women continued into the 70s. In 72, Senate Commission testimony uncovered that at least 2,000 poor black mothers on welfare in the South were sterilized, many of whom were threatened with an end to their welfare benefits if they didn't consent. Native American women were also threatened with an end to their welfare benefits if they didn't consent to sterilization. Others unknowingly consented as directions weren't given in their native language. Native Americans accused the Indian Health Service of sterilizing at least 25% of Native American women between the ages of 15 and 44 during the 1970s. According to the General Accounting Office, almost 3,500 were. Sadly, sterilization wasn't the only amoral medical trend of the 20th century that singled out women. They were also disproportionate targets for lobotomization, a neurosurgical procedure that severed connections in the brain's prefrontal lobe and caused patients to permanently be rendered infantilized. During lobotomy's heyday in the 40s and 50s, men outnumbered women in state medical hospitals, yet females comprised over 60% of lobotomy patients. Mostly because psychiatrists believed it was easier for women to return to lives dedicated solely to domestic duties than to rehabilitate men who had to act as breadwinners. Of the first 20 lobotomies performed by Dr. Walter Freeman, the flashy, reckless physician who popularized the surgery in America, 17 were women. Along with behavioral and mental problems, Freeman would also give lobotomies for such ailments as migraines and postpartum depression. Using nothing more than a hammer and an ice pick, Freeman boasted that he could do a lobotomy without anesthesia in 10 minutes. He once performed 25 in a single day. Carol Noel Duncanson, the daughter of one woman who underwent a lobotomy while pregnant in order to cure her chronic migraines in 1949, described how her once brilliant and vivacious mother came home incapacitated. The woman could not feed herself, she could not toilet, she could not speak, and she was combative, she recalled. While her mother eventually relearned basic skills, she remained childlike and unable to care for her own children, who were sent to foster care. She never had a life after her lobotomy, Duncanson said. She had nothing. As lobotomies, mercifully, fell out of favor, they were replaced with antipsychotic drugs like Thorazine, which is still in use today. And since we're on the subject of pills, let's talk about pills, which we're on the subject of. Valium, a highly addictive sedative, was introduced in 1963 and quickly became popular amongst disaffected housewives, earning it the moniker Mother's Little Helper. Doctors prescribed twice as many tranquilizers, sedatives, and stimulants to women than men at the time in an attempt to, well, shut them up. In many cases, wrote the author of a 1979 paper in a Journal of Women's Studies, there is no medical reason for use of the drugs, but they become a chemical support system to adjust a woman to a frustrating or unfulfilling marriage, divorce, lifestyle, or work situation. A 1971 review of medical journals found the way in which these drugs were advertised reinforced stereotypes. One caption accompanying a portrayal of a woman behind the bars of a broom and mop handles read, "You can't set her free, but you can help her feel less anxious." At the time in which doctors were overprescribing psychiatric medications to give women the fuel they needed in order to wash their husband's skid-marked boxer shorts without complaint, 93% of all doctors and 97% of all gynecologists were male. A 1974 study presented at the American Association of Obstetricians and Gynecologists found that 86% of women surveyed only saw their OBGYNs on a regular basis, treating them like general practitioners and deferring to their all-male, all-knowing authority. If there's a way to not feel ineffably vulnerable when your feet are in stirrups, I'd like to hear it. Women have, for centuries, been socialized to be passive recipients of medical care. In a 1970 hearing before the U.S. Senate, one male, doctor declared his opposition to the labeling of risks on the packaging of oral contraceptives. A misguided effort to inform such women leads only to anxiety on their part and loss of confidence in the physician, he said. They want him to tell them what to do, not to confuse them by asking them to make decisions beyond their comprehension. The idea of informing such a woman is not possible. But, and I'm so sorry to speak out of turn, please forgive me, Mr. Doctor, women should be informed about their health options, as the risk factors and symptoms of diseases manifest themselves differently by sex. One example being cardiovascular disease, which has been the leading cause of mortality in American women since 1989. Although one in four women die of the disease, according to the American Heart Association, only one-third of cardiovascular clinical trial subjects are female. For the majority of the 20th century, studies on heart disease exclusively utilized male subjects, even though researchers have found gender differences in response to cardiac medications. The heart failure drug Digoxin, for example, has been associated with an increased risk of death amongst women, but not men. 1982's multiple risk factor intervention trial, one of the first to find a link between cholesterol and heart disease, had almost 13,000 men and zero women. 1995's Physicians' Health Study, which found aspirin use reduced the risk of heart attack, involved almost 23,000 men, and presumably because they were all off getting their hair done at the time, no women. For men, the most common symptom of a heart attack is chest pain. While women often experience this as well, they may also experience other, less common symptoms, like shortness of breath, nausea, and weakness. The fact that these symptoms aren't considered the masculine norm can lead to women being undiagnosed, which can be fatal. Men are most likely to be diagnosed with heart disease, yet women made up more than half of all heart disease-related fatalities in 2011. They're also more likely than men to die in the year following a heart attack. When it comes to heart health, being a woman can quite literally kill you. But, and I know you've been waiting for it, here's some good news, all right? In 1970, the National Organization for Women filed a class action lawsuit against all medical schools in the U.S., which forced them to begin admitting female students. By 1975, the number of women in medicine had almost tripled, and as Merrill already told you, for the first time in 2017, more than 50% of medical school students were female. The more female doctors exist, the more female patients will be taken seriously. So there's something to look forward to, and by something, I mean not the grim specter of death.
You know, I just looked it up, and apparently before that class action suit, the number of women medical students was less than 9%. Isn't that amazing?
Honestly, that seems high.
Well, they're so, you know, women had those feeble brains back then.
Well, but then also, what are they doing with their degrees? If like 96% of men were doctors and 9% were students.
They were getting their MRS degree.
What's that?
That's a Mrs. That's what they used to say when I was in college. Are you getting your MRS degree?
Mm.
You know, eugenics seems like the kind of thing that Trump would like to pretend that he invented. I hope he's not planning to have ICE start using it at the separating of family zero tolerance thing.
Well, I mean, but if he acts like it's a new thing, then he wouldn't be able to manufacture Make America Forcibly Sterilize Minorities and the Poor Again hats.
Yeah,
so,
those would be great hats.
Little words, big sellers.
Yeah. I also really love the idea that informing women about their health options is a misguided effort because it causes a lack of confidence in her doctor.
Well, if God hadn't informed Eve about the existence of knowledge, the world would be a much happier place, no?
You know, that is so true, and we would still have talking snakes, which I would love. I would like to have the talking snakes.
They sound cute, cuddly.
Yeah. Damn that Eve.
Ugh, what a cunt.
Chapter 11, Entertainment.
Lily St. Cyr and Caccini and vaudeville's Ava Tanguay were all of the rage until a certain age when they just put the laundry away.
Well, Well, here we are at the chapter on women in entertainment, which I've waited for because I know women did not suffer very many indignities in this field because there just aren't that many opportunities for women.
All I know is that this women in entertainment chapter is the one that we were always meant to write. Finally, it's one that we could write in our Cosby-induced sleep, really.
I don't know if that's right because Cosby didn't drug any writers, did he?
One of his 60 accusers was a writer, actually.
Huh. Well, you know, one out of 60 isn't too bad. Guess Cosby was a progressive. A lot of men in entertainment don't even think writers are part of the process.
That's actually a good point. I guess he's not really like other alleged serial rapists.
He's really not.
He's a mensch.
In a class by himself.
He really is.
When we first started researching this book, I had a feeling we were going to run into a lot of upsetting bullshit. But I was still surprised when we started compiling this chapter about women in entertainment, which I, of course, knew was going to contain tales of female exploitation. It was still a surprise to read this. Quote, "The theater arose more than two millennia ago in ancient Greece, where women were strictly prohibited from being on stage, as it was considered too dangerous to give them such a prominent platform. Even the most renowned characters, like the tragic heroine Antigone, were portrayed exclusively by male actors. So apparently they didn't mind giving female impersonators a dangerous platform, which I guess they figured was kind of woke. Really? Women prohibited from being on stage? I mean, even though in my lifetime I've run into plenty of comedy nights at clubs where there were essentially no women, and I've long been aware that in most movies the only female character would be killed off in Act One, right after any cute household pets, because their deaths, and also their lives, were just a device to spur the male lead into a heroic adventure." Oh no, I'm having another flashback. Feels like a past life regression again. Where am I? Looks really familiar. I think it's the 21st century, so that's good. At least I know my way around. And this seems familiar. I have a job doing a radio show at a new internet radio station called Comedy World that I was told would be reinventing radio. I've worked in comedy my whole life, so what could go wrong? The head of programming knows I love dogs, so he gave me a show about animals. Of course I said yes, and I decided I needed a partner, so I invited my friend comedian Laura Keitlinger, cat rescuer and fellow animal lover, to join me. Headquarters is a big warehouse in Los Angeles done up like an indoor trailer court. Over there are some trailers used as offices, and there are some other ones used as production facilities. And that one over in the corner, tricked out with the white picket fences, astroturf lawns, and deck chairs, is, I guess, in case any comedians need to do some ironic sitting. At the moment, there are no advertisers. But, you know, these are just the early days, and the CEO says they're going to be on the verge of massive expansion into a million new markets. So while we're waiting for the world to catch up to us, comedians who are used to dealing with live audiences are sitting in these trailers broadcasting all day long to, well, it isn't clear to who. Earlier, I heard that comedian Bobby Slayton had been offering $50 out of his own pocket to anyone who will call his show and prove they were listening. And he's had no takers. Still, every day, the CEO says they're adding more and more new markets. Everything's moving forward, he says. So Laura and I start doing our new show called We're All Animals on a Saturday afternoon. Our plan is to do topics about the animal kingdom. Today, we're doing a compare and contrast of animals versus humans mating segment, in which we measure our personal experiences against those of our friends the squids, who have sex for 2 weeks straight. Also, we'll interview a forensic entomologist who will explain how they can tell the time of a murder by analyzing the insects on a corpse. But we're doing these shows for the same zero listeners Bobby Slayton has never had to pay. Until the CEO comes in and announces that a quote-unquote programming consultant has been hired. I know from all my previous jobs in show business that a programming consultant is the beginning of the end. Now it's a week later, and the guy who hired us is taking us to lunch, where we are all pretending to chat cheerily as we wait for him to start dropping shoes. The consultant, he's telling us, has asked us to refocus our programming on the needs of our primary listener demographic, 18 to 34-year-old males. I'm thinking, oh, geez, you mean even non-existent listeners are 18 to 34-year-old males? Our research, the CEO continues, says that our target demographic isn't interested in a show about animals. What they'd rather hear
is a sexy show about sex. Laura and I are staring at each other. A deep, penetrating stare into a common void full of funhouse mirrors where those weird World War II ambulance sirens are wailing. We like the paycheck and we don't really want to be fired. We're not really quite sure what to say. Okay, I say, attempting a lateral chest move. Well then, how about if we do a smart, funny show about sex? No, the CEO is saying. That won't work. We need for it to be more masturbatory. The sirens start wailing again. Did he really say that? I know a lot of TV execs probably think that, but no one just says it outright. In all my years of hundreds of projects that have fallen through, this is the first time I've heard someone say, what we want from you is less comedy, more jerking off. I thought doing a show for no audience already was kind of masturbatory, my friend Laura says. Uh-oh, I'm the only one laughing. So if you ladies would like to give this new show a shot, the CEO was saying, and the room has started spinning. Oh no, there's those World War II sirens going again. How do I get out of here? Help someone, I'm in hell. I don't want to live through this again. Help me, please.
Meryl, time's up on that dreary recollection. Snap out of that startup.
Oh, whew, that was terrifying. Thank you, Megan. For the first time, I can't wait to get back to the ancient world where, as it turns out, it's been a reliably weird path for women in entertainment right from the beginning. As usual, ancient Egypt was ahead of the curve, featuring women as musicians and dancers in a lot of events, even though as a Jew and a female, I would definitely have been a slave. But let's not get hung up on the downside yet, because ancient Egypt was a progressive, egalitarian picnic compared to the fun that was ancient Greece, where, no surprise, there were zero women allowed on stage. And ditto ancient Rome. All roles, including all female roles, were played by male actors in masks. If it's any comfort, and by the way, it's not, the public opinion in those days of actors of both genders was so low they were on a par with criminals and prostitutes. Many actors were also slaves, which present-day actors will tell you they still are, though now if they get beaten by their masters as punishment for a bad performance, it's because they paid a dominatrix. Women in all the creative arts have always been getting screwed. In Africa, where women have usually dominated in the production of pottery, very few scholars ever credited them with making the figurative ceramic sculptures found by archaeologists that you see in museums because, you know, sculpture is thought of as being part of high art, and that means male creator, as opposed to crafts being low art for the ladies. In a related story, it wasn't until the 1100s that any Chinese women painters received any kind of mention at all in art history. And when I say mention, I mean that only 1.7% to 3.2% of all painters recorded in all of ancient Chinese art history are said to be women. You know, that seems just slightly low. The truth is that most contributions that women made to the arts before the birth of Christ went unrecorded and are therefore hard to track. Equally disturbing, many of the references to women of artistic ability get thrown into the category of courtesan, or high-class prostitute entertainer trained in singing, dancing, and poetry, which is how they're usually described. These artistically trained women are common in just about every culture and time period. In India, in the 1500s, they were called tawaif, highly sophisticated women who contributed to music, dance, theater, and the Urdu literary tradition, and catered to male nobility. In Japan, there was an elite courtesan known as the oiran, referred to as a woman of pleasure, though the pleasure being referred to is definitely not hers. In the 18th and 19th centuries, more than 4,000 prostitutes working on a quota system could be found in densely populated pleasure districts that sprung up in Japan, a kind of predatory theme park where men could be lured for a day. Though this went on for hundreds of years, no writings by the so-called women of pleasure were allowed to exist because it would have been bad for business, especially since most of the artistically trained women involved were born into poverty and sold to brothels when they were 7 or 8 years old by their desperate parents. After being trained in polite cultural accomplishments like dancing, singing, and playing musical instruments to make them more attractive to men, they were then trapped in these so-called pleasure districts working off their 10-year brothel contracts. Many of these women were dead by the age of 20. In China, as far back as the 7th century, the term household courtesan was the common way to refer to entertainers who were called sing-song girls and kept by the hundreds, even thousands, at the various elite imperial courts. Although other smaller elite households also owned some, but in smaller quantities, which was still possible because there was no Costco yet, forcing you to purchase all your courtesans only in giant industrial-sized quantities. But hey, how about a totally different version of women in entertainment? During the 10th century, there was, amazingly enough, a German nun called Herrosfrida, who wrote comedic plays and is often credited as the first female playwright in history. To repeat, she was a nun and a playwright in Germany in the 10th century, and she wrote comedy, which is amazing. I don't need to remind you that the 10th century was no one's idea of a laugh riot. On the bright side, because she was in a convent, I guess there was no male supervisor trying to stop her. Which brings us to the Middle Ages. Usually not a great time for women in any walk of life, and the arts were no exception. When Rome fell and the early Christian church took over, they immediately got busy destroying a lot of Greek and Roman art and literature. Then, not content to rest on their laurels, they also issued a succession of decrees banning all performing art in the West between the 9th and the 14th centuries, except religious historical enactments and morality plays organized by, guess who? The church. And, of course, no girls allowed in any parts, even the Virgin Mary, played by men. But in a parallel universe, as it turned out, the British crown had been developing a taste for theater. Richard III, Henry VIII, and Elizabeth I were all big theater fans. So to compensate, when the theaters were shut down, well-to-do patrons of the arts apparently hosted secretive illegal performances in their home for family and friends. And since they were illegal anyway, they figured, what the hell, let's do something really risque and use women actors. Which, of course, did not straighten everything out. Because by the time Shakespeare showed up in the 1500s and began writing all those meaty, complex parts for women, it was still the law that all the parts had to be played only by men. Maybe that's why Shakespeare's plots so often call for his female characters to be masquerading as boys. Because they had to be played by boys anyway. And here's a brain teaser. There's anecdotal evidence that a few women auditioned for parts pretending to be boys in order to be allowed to play the girl. The good news is that at the same time, over in Italy and France, things were loosening up a little. In 1568, a woman named Maddalena Casulana published the first ever book of musical works by a woman. In the dedication, she states that her intentions in publishing were to show the world the foolish error of men who so greatly believe themselves to be the masters of high intellectual gifts that these gifts cannot, it seems to them, be equally common among women. Nicely done, Maddie. Which brings us to the Renaissance and a theater troupe that started in the late 1500s called Commedia dell'Arte, who decided to test out the completely crazy, almost unimaginable idea of allowing women on stage. Its critics gave them scathing reviews, with legendary playwright Ben Jonson himself referring to one female performer of the Commedia as a, quote, tumbling whore, which she couldn't even use then as her Twitter name because no internet. A private letter written to the Bishop of London and signed by a man named Thomas Brand noted, "Glad I am to say that they were hissed, hooted, and pippin-pelted from the stage, so I do not think they will soon be ready to try the same again." Guess again. There were plenty more setbacks to come, but the tide had kind of turned. By the time of King Charles II in 1660, the upper crust of English society had somehow adjusted to the terrifying specter of women performing on a stage, and somehow survived. Apparently, it could be done. Moreover, the new king himself was determined to open the door for women players in England, claiming he wanted to help quell the moral outrage that his subjects felt watching boys dressing up as females for acting parts. He decreed that now all female parts must be played by a woman. What an idea! So crazy, it just might work. Naturally, the reaction of male actors was mixed. Some saw it as adding realism. Others regarded it as unnatural. A definition of that word that apparently caused Noah Webster to hit a permanent spin cycle in his grave. Also around 1600, opera arrived, with some productions actually calling for shock, gasp, women in starring roles. Although female opera singers still faced plenty of challenges, like female soprano parts being given first to a type of male performer known as the castrati, a fine tradition of adolescent boy mutilating that was embraced unchecked since 3000 BC, allowing these lucky lads to retain a woman's high vocal pitch through the miracle of dick removal. Because the church, in its wisdom, knew that even a penis and testicle-free mutilated young boy singer was still preferable to an unharmed one with a vagina. They continued to hire castrati exclusively in the papal choir until it became illegal in 1870. Interesting that they didn't mind improving on God's creations as long as it meant fewer women entertainers. Meanwhile, over in France, clerics and moralists were very busy fretting about the morals of women, which they felt were degenerating based on the sexy fashions and a relaxation of taboos against female swearing and gambling. There were even reports of women overdoing it with food, drink, and nicotine. Uh-oh. This turned into a continuing French debate called Les Querelles des Femmes, the women question, about the rightful place of women in society.